Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of Putting It Together. We're well into January now. It's Wednesday, the 10th of January, and today's episode features my guest, our guest, David Gregg. I'm really excited to have David on the programme. It's been great talking to him. And we went right back. We went right back to suspect culture and to San Diego. And I started to realise, actually, that David Gregg had written some of the stuff that I saw when I was at the Academy, the Royal Scottish Academy of Music and Drama, and some of the first plays, really, I saw as a student. And when I started to think, really, about writing and about theatre and about how it's made, not just going to see it, but about how it's all put together. And that was an exciting realization for me, and in a sense I had it as I spoke to David. So I'm sure you'll enjoy hearing that and how it unfolds. One of the really exciting things that we got to talking about quite near the beginning of our conversation was how he writes and how on a daily basis he actually goes about the process of putting together a play. And isn't that what we're all about on Putting It Together? The brass tacks about how we actually go about making these things, that not just the end product, but how we go about the process of putting them together from the very start. And David spoke really eloquently and in great detail about that. So I look forward to hearing your feedback on that. How he does it, and how he did it way back then, and how he does it now, and how those things differ. He also talked about how he avoids really directing his own work, and why he avoids directing his own work. And it's a little about the challenges that the writer lays down for the director, and how if the writer and the director are one and the same person, how those challenges may not be such challenges. You're taking out a problem that needs to be there in order for someone to make something of value. He talks really well about that. And then, of course, towards the end, we get on to his writing of the book of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the musical, and how Dennis Kelly at the same time was writing the book for Matilda, the musical. And he goes into some detail about how you write Roald Dahl for the stage, and what the challenges are associated with that. And it's all really exciting stuff. And it's good to have a conversation with someone who's not an actor, who doesn't purport to be an actor. And we really see another side of this industry, a side that's fascinated me for a long time. I do see myself as a bit of a writer. I certainly have written things in the past, and I've got some ideas that I want to write. Certainly this season, actually, right now is January, and at the moment I'm not doing a great deal of acting until a couple of months into the year. And my project is not just the podcast, but also writing something. I've got something that I want to write, that I'm going to write. And when people are asking me what I'm doing, I tell them I'm doing a podcast and I'm also writing a short musical, and that's what I'm going to be doing. So really, there couldn't come a better time for me to sit down and talk to David Gregg about how you write, what it's all about. And we start by talking about how you start. And I can't think of anything more fascinating, really, at this time in the year and at this time in my creative process. How do you start? And his answer, which of course you'll learn in a second, is that you don't. You start by jumping to the middle or going to some other place. You never sit with a blank page in front of you and think, now I'm going to start writing my thing. And I'm really glad I got to chat to him about that before I have to sit down and start writing my thing. Because it's been a while since I sat down and wrote something. And working on the Christmas show that I just have with a great composer has made me want to write music again. But I've been looking for a way in. And the two things I needed were for David to tell me not to start at the beginning, and also for someone to give me a deadline. And that is something that I'm working on this week. And more about that in next week's podcast once I get a bit more clarity on it. But what I'm really looking for is for someone to say, yes, you can write this thing and we need it by this date. And that is how I'm going to get to writing it. And I'll tell you perhaps what it is, what it's called, what the content is a little bit later once I get started on it. For now, what I'm doing is working on this podcast and trying to bring you the most exciting and the most interesting guests that I can this year. And it may seem self-explanatory, but the challenge for Pit Pod this year, for Putting It Together, is to do 52 episodes and to bring you a new guest every week, someone who's going to excite you creatively, and to bring a diverse range of guests from all across the industry, one every week. I just That's my challenge to myself, and I'm saying it out loud so that you know about it. And I know that there are people listening from all over the world and from all corners of the industry, and I hope that you'll continue to share it with your friends and your colleagues and people you think might find it useful and interesting, because I want this to be as wide and as broad a creative conversation as possible, ultimately. So I won't dilly-dally any longer because we've got a really exciting interview to hear. So here I am with David Gregg, and we are putting it together. I've started it. I'm not very good at beginnings either. That's talking and then I see them maybe cut in later. How do you do beginnings? You must have a tip on how to start.
I just start by not starting. So what I would normally do when I'm writing is I try to write randomly.
Right.
So I think of the whole story and think it up, but I don't necessarily write the beginning first. I'll write the middle, or usually what I do is I sort of chop the story up,
okay,
and then write it in a random sequence. And then I then see where the beginning is and put the beginning at the beginning. Because if you sit at the beginning and think, this is the beginning, it's just horrible. And everything you think of is stupid or pretentious or too clever or too, you know, you just don't know what it. But when you do it randomly, you just think, oh, of course, that's the beginning. And there it is. And it's fine. It's perfect. It's done. So I find the beginning by not beginning. I never begin. It's never,
Do you just dive in sometimes to a really high drama, a point of high drama or something? And just...
I actually have quite a specific method, which I have used for about the last 10 years, and I so far have not given up using. So I would really do two things. One is I try to tell the story to people whenever I get the chance. And by doing that, the story starts to exist and take shape as a told thing that's not written down, but is in my head, and I can tell it. And then at the same time, I write on index cards the sorts of things I want in the play, maybe a funny line I think should be in it, or a moment. And then finally, I would write the story down the way I tell it, like to someone in the back of a cab. That's one of my favourites, is if in a cab, people say, what do you do? And you say, oh, I'm a writer, or I work in theatre. And they say, oh, what are you working on at the moment?
Mm-hmm.
And I make it a rule that I have to answer, and I have to say, it's a story about, and I have to just try and tell it and get as far as I can and notice where it's good or bad or stumbly or rubbish. So I would just tell it like that, except I write that down, and then I cut that up with scissors. And then I shoogle all of the index cards and cut up things and just pick a random bit out.
Okay.
And whichever is, I just write that. I just write whatever that is. So if it's a scene or a line or a moment, I just try and respond to it until eventually I have a big pile of stuff. And then if I've been very clever, I've numbered everything in its correct way and I can put it all back in what I think is the order. But sometimes I haven't done that, and I just look and just go, well, that goes there, that goes there, that goes there.
Right.
And that would be... And then you would have a draft, but you'd have a draft without ever having a moment where you've sat down and had the weight of like, oh my God, I'm writing
this. Yeah.
Because none of it is. You're just responding to a random fragment.
Sure. And then do you often end up with too much? Do you ever end up with too little?
Yes, of course. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, of course you definitely end up with too much. You almost, with that method, part of the process is you will end up, let's say you want to write a 20-minute play. Sometimes people ask you to do short things like a 20-minute play. Well, a 20-minute play, you probably want about 20 pages. But with that method that I've described, you will definitely, your first pile will probably contain 60 pages. And then, so obviously the first thing that you do is you just cut away double stuff that you don't need. It's very obvious. Get yourself down to about 30, probably pretty quickly you can get yourself down to 30 pages. Because a lot of it's literally you've done the same thing twice and there's just one version that's better than the other. So you just go with that. But you cut it down to 30, and then that's when it becomes interesting, because then you've got a piece that should have a beginning, middle, and end. Probably got some missing bits as well.
Right.
And so from that point, you're just starting to shape and hone and shape and hone. But the point for me is you've got something. Your material is there, and you're working with material and cut away here, add there. You know. So yeah, you would have too much. But I think a big illusion about writing is, or at least for me, writing is not difficult. Writing is easy. Writing stuff that's good and usable is difficult. So my technique is to write a lot, and somewhere in it is the good and usable stuff, rather than to agonize trying to create the good and usable stuff without the rest. I just think, fuck it.
Okay.
You're allowed to swear on this.
Yeah, go for it. Okay.
But to me, it's much less labor to produce 60 pages to find 10 good ones than it is to not write until you have 10 good pages. That would be my approach.
So by definition, if you just keep going, eventually you'll get the right thing.
Yeah, and also I think the random thing is helpful because like if I turn over a card and it says, you know, Billy tries to buy drugs off Steve, because for everything, that's part of my story. If I build to that and I've already written the scene before it, and whereas if I just turn it over, like it could be anywhere. I could go, oh yeah, why don't we put them in the bakery or in the park, or all right, they're in the kids' swing park. And I'm going, they're in the kids' swing park. Oh, they're on a swing. So maybe one of them's on a swing. So, you know, I'm very fresh. I'm not thinking of things in a. And so then, you write that, and you put it away. You turn it. You write the next scene. You write the next scene. But every scene is getting freshness. It's getting an energy of difference. So then, when you put it all together, usually what you find is some of those ideas you have to tone down or change or shift. But some of them actually have really set you off somewhere.
Yeah.
Another example would be if you set that in a swing park just because you're fresh and that's a good idea. Then suddenly there's another scene that comes along and you immediately go, actually, that would work in the swing park. And so things happen. I think the randomness creates for me stuff that I wouldn't do if I sat and thought it in order. If I sat and thought it in order, sure, I'd never get there. But by coming at it randomly, you get stuff in that freshens it and makes it unusual or interesting, I think. Also, it just doesn't kill my brain. I mean, it's literally that feeling of going, oh, God, I've got to write a play. Because I'll do it with an adaptation as well, where I've got much less freedom. But it's just much more fun to me that I don't know what I'm going to do this morning. So I turn it over and I go, all right, I'm doing scene 3.
Okay.
You know, and I just do scene 3 and then I'll do scene 10. And, you know, so you just have that feeling of not have this great weight above you of this horrible unwritten thing that needs to be brilliant. You just
isn't
have...
that what everyone who wants to write something is battling against the idea of the blank page or the massive idea that has to be brilliant.
Yeah, and there's another way I've often thought about it, which is that I have to find ways to trick my brain into playing rather than working. And for the moment, this trickery works. Eventually, there'll come a point where my brain will have learned it enough. And when I turn over the card, it'll go, oh, God, you need this to be good, don't you? Because it's always when you turn over cards, it becomes plays. And then I'll have to find another trick. But for now, this trick works. But you need to find a way to let your brain not think this is important. This is someone is going to judge this. I am going to potentially be humiliated if this isn't, you know, you need to get all of that.
Yeah.
Just play. Like you have to feel really free. And that's part of the joy is that, you know, when I said about whatever he was, Stan and Bill in the playground with the possible drug buying scene, I might decide to do it in rhyme just for a laugh, just to see. And that might be a dreadful idea. And that would become quite clear quite quickly. And so it's fine. You just, you know, turn over another card, do it. You know, it'll always, it just makes it less important, I think.
Do you have rules about that you have to do something every day?
I don't do it that way. What I tend to do is create facts on the ground that mean that, and I mean, and this is a bit of a horrible thing, but what I do usually is I can't really write unless tickets are on sale. Right. So the way I've said this in the past, but it is true, is that I find it difficult to write unless the consequence of writing something shit is better than the consequence of writing nothing at all. So by which I mean, there's a bit of a double negative there, but what I mean is this. Imagine the actors come out on stage and they have to say, ladies and gentlemen, I'm terribly sorry. We don't know what to say. There's no lines.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah.
That would be so awful.
He didn't do anything. Yeah. Sorry.
And so that would be so awful that the actors coming out and saying, albeit a bad play, is still better than them having to do that.
Okay.
Yep. So therefore, anything I write is better than the consequence situation. Anything I write is better than them having to come out and go, I'm terribly sorry, ladies and gentlemen, David has failed to write a play.
I'd love to be in the room when that happened, just to be part of it, though.
I've come close. But the so therefore, I need to create a situation where I force into being a situation where not writing is worse than writing anything at all.
Right.
And that's usually by making tickets go on sale.
Okay. And are you in...
And then once that's there, well, I will procrastinate as much as anybody else. I'll do anything. But eventually there comes a point where, you know, it's terrible. So you have to write. So it's not like I make rules. I have to write every day. It's as you reach a point where you have to do it. There's plays going on.
Is that more present now that with your position at the Lyceum, where you're making the decision that tickets go on sale and that type of thing? Has that become more of a thing, or have you always done that?
Well, it certainly allows... I mean, it certainly puts me into a position where... no, I've always done it for myself.
Right.
In fact, it's only... This is weird. This is me... If anything, it makes it slightly more complicated because I'm both producer and writer. So I use my colleagues in that way to sort of, do we all agree tickets now go on sale sort of thing? And then once we've all agreed, obviously I have to write it. But I suppose in the past, I suppose it gives me the position of not putting the tickets on sale, which is another way of avoiding doing it. So I could go, well, this play would be really good. We could do it next season. I don't know if I'm quite ready. You know, whereas another artistic director might go, no, it's on. So you have to do it. So yeah, I have to use my colleagues as a sort of, with my own work. I mean, it's the Lyceum and my own work is complicated. You know, like in this season, there's nothing written by me recently, and the creditors was adapted by me a while ago. But in next season, there's probably going to be about three things, I think, that are or certainly two, and so that's becoming a very real issue for me. Is like, right, it's going to be in the program. I am going to have to do it. I'd better find the time, you know.
And then, of course, is it true that all your writing happens right underneath the theatre rehearsal room now? Or is that what's one of the places that happens?
So what you're referring to is I've rented an office now in what was a cafe, a shop, on Grindley Street under the Lyceum offices and directly opposite the box office of the Lyceum, and it has a nice big window in it, and I that is currently my office and where I do a lot of writing.
Yeah.
But I've always rented an office, I say always, certainly for the last 15 years, I've rented an office in Edinburgh. It's just now, obviously, I've moved my location. But when my kids were born, I couldn't have an office at home because we needed the room. And from really that point onwards, I had to have an office outside.
Mm-hmm.
But I use it in an odd way. What I've tended to find is that by having the office, I write in cafes.
Right.
Because I'm avoiding going to the office. But if I didn't have the office, I somehow couldn't write in cafes. Because I tried that at one point. I thought, why am I spending all this money renting an office and I spend all my time writing in cafes? So I stopped renting the office. But then I found I couldn't write in cafes. I got very frustrated. I didn't like it.
Wow.
So there's some sort of weird double negative. And the other places that I there's a cottage that I have in the Highlands where there's no telephone or internet or anything. And I will, when the project is ready, that's a good place to go. I can get a lot done there.
Right.
But it's no point going there if the project isn't ready, because you just I would waste time. It's too frustrating. You need to be really in the writing zone to go away and do that.
So when it's ready to be written, you mean, when you're not dabbling around researching things or
I suppose when it's begun rolling down the hill,
tickets like are on sale.
It's on sale, but also, you know, I've maybe written 15-20 pages of stuff, and I kind of know it's coming. Then that's really what. Then a week, I will do a lot. I'll get 100 pages out. It'll be really, you know, because I can do 3 session days, and I can. There's no distraction at all, and also no emotional. I can't even get. You know, sometimes if any creative thing, but now we're so interconnected that it's not just about work interfering or even your own distraction of like, oh, Googling things on the internet, but it's. You get a text and it's your mum, or you get a text and it's a colleague, and it's just a bit of slightly annoying news, say.
Yeah.
And it just niggles, and it bumps you. Whereas when I'm away writing, I literally receive no information outside. So I live in my own head 100%. For a 3 or 4 day stretch, and I can really get a lot done. But as I say, you have to be already moving for that to have real value.
Sure.
If you're not already moving, it sometimes just feels frustrating, and you're not, you know, it's dispiriting. You need to have some forward momentum for that.
That makes sense. So it turns out that I didn't actually realize that these two things went together, but that the two of the first productions I saw when I went to the RSAMD were. One was Suspect Culture's 8,000 Meters.
Oh, right. Wow.
And the other was San Diego.
Wow.
When some of the actors in the same year as us, I did the CTP course, did a production of San Diego.
Right.
I didn't even connect the two at the time as having been written by the same person. Did you solely write 8,000 Meters, or is there some sort of collaborative element?
Well, Suspect Culture, we had a method where we would collaborate as a gang on the idea and on the... story, and we would often do workshops on sort of staging and stuff, but eventually there would come a point where I would write, and it would solely be me writing, but a great deal of the shape of everything and of the what was going to happen would have been decided as a group, that makes it sound like committee, but you know, we'd have just worked it out in a room. So 8,000 meters, we knew we were going to do climbing, we'd done workshops, we'd gone out climbing, we'd researched climbing together, we'd worked out what fun ways you could do climbing on stage, we'd tried to, you know, we'd done a whole load of stuff like that, and then eventually I sat down and wrote something. And then but with San Diego, that was a different process. That was wholly my own imagination.
That was later, a good bit later then.
No, it was earlier.
Was it?
No, San Diego was written. San Diego was written in 2000, and the reason that I know that, or was it 1999? Because I think San Diego, a huge sort of central element of San Diego is aeroplanes and also sort of angry second generation immigrant character, and also. The stuff to do with Palestine and the stuff. Anyway, it was just very interesting that for all the play's strange initial reception, when 2001 happened and then there was the Twin Towers and all that, suddenly the play's use of planes and kind of, there was just a lot in it where it seemed like somehow weirdly San Diego had kind of... either anticipated or was in some way channeling some of the same sort of zeitgeist that eventually emerged into the World Trade Center attack. But it was before then. So and I think it was basically the year before. I think it was 2000 that I wrote it.
I think now you mention it, I saw another production of it at the Tron, actually. Would that have been... That wouldn't have been the first production of it, would it?
If it was the Tron, it probably would have been. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I saw it twice. There you go. And yeah. I didn't know... I had never met you. I didn't know who you were. Yeah. And then I went and drank in the same pub as right beside where you live without realizing the connection. We were sort of just...
In Glasgow or in...
No,
in,
at the Albert.
Oh, the Albert.
Yeah,
oh,
North Queensferry. Yeah, we kind of almost crossed paths many, many times.
Why? What took you to the Albert?
My ex was... who lived in North Queensferry and then babysat for you.
Ah, right.
Do you remember? And then, yes. But we kind of maybe met one day or something like that. So it's a weird little... So then Suspect Culture was created with that ethos in mind, with that kind of group dynamic.
Yeah, Suspect Culture was Graham, Itoff, and I were at Bristol University together. We made shows together and we created a theatre company together. With that ethos, I mean, it was various things going on at that time. Because you remember when we actually created Suspect Culture, we were going back to about 1992, 93, so going quite a long way back. And it was really two things. One was that we just wanted to make work, and we, you know, often like a group of people recently graduated, you make your own company and stuff. But I think we had in our mind a few things. We had Europeanness. We were very attracted by, we thought, exciting, interesting ways of making theatre that we were seeing in Europe. I think we were very privileged because we made a conscious decision to go to Glasgow, not London. That was partly my own sort of Scottish background. But Graham from Lancashire, I think he was a bit sort of sniffy about that London, you know, and quite fancied the idea of a second base. And I remember at the time, my very foolish, I specialise in certain foolish predictions, and I remember saying to Graham about Mayfest, because Mayfest still happened then, and I said, Mayfest, Graham, in now, and it was 1991 or whatever, is as big as the Edinburgh Fringe was 15 years ago, and in 10 years' time, it's going to be as big as the Edinburgh Fringe is. So we're here, we're going to be in at the start, you know. And it was really, Mayfest was kind of closed within about 5 years. But I think there was a feeling, I had a feeling that Glasgow was an interesting place to be, and indeed, I think that turned out to be right. And I think that combination of wanting to make our own centre, if you like, so not to be just a slight chippiness, maybe to sort of say we're going to do our own thing, and then the Europeanness was the two sort of impulses in the first instance, and then out of that came this sort of ethos of, we wouldn't ever call it devised because that implies something, I think, about the writing process. It was it was communal group collaborative work, and then each person did their job in the more normal way of theatre. So I wrote a script, Graham directed, actors acted, designers designed. But that before we got there, we'd all worked together so that the whole thing had a kind of conception that was coherent.
And devise would not cover that as a definition, or would be inappropriate, I think.
Well, it just, at that time, there was sometimes it's just about words that people use. And at that time, that word didn't seem like the right word for us.
Yeah. Did you have a base then?
We did. We bunked in for a while with 784 when in the 90s when Ian Rickey was running 784. We had a little cupboard that we rented, and we were there for a while, and then we sort of got funding. I remember we got what was then called, was it called regular funding or franchise funding? It's all changed, the names of these things. Now it's called regularly funded organisations. I think at one point it was called foundation organisations. Anyway, there was one stage where it was called franchise funding, and I think we got one of the franchises.
Right.
Funny to think of that phraseology now. But franchise, anyway, I think we got that around about 1996 or 7, something like that. Right. So it took us a few years, but you know, we got there. And of course, at the same time as that, I was also writing my own work. So I had at that point a double career.
Right.
So I had Suspect Culture, where I did about a show a year with Suspect Culture, but I also did my own writing.
Right. And has there been a time since then where you solely did your own writing?
Yeah, there was a bit. Well, you see, that's been the funny thing. I left Suspect Culture around about 2000 and I'm not going to remember, but sort of maybe let's say 2007 or 8, something like that. Mm-hmm. And obviously I only took up the Lyceum job a couple of years ago. So you could say in between I was only doing my own work, but actually yep. I always had included within my own work, collaborative work, directing work, producing work and stuff. Like I produced I did quite a lot of work teaching writing and playwriting and workshopping playwriting with playwrights, particularly in the Middle East. So mm-hmm. I had a lot of connections with the Middle East, and so during the whole period of the Arab Spring and thereabouts, I curated a season at Oran Moor of work by Arab writers. So that would be an example. And I did also an Edinburgh Festival thing where I brought over writers from Palestine. So that would be an example where there was always, I suppose, the element which in Suspect Culture, there was a theatre company and I was part of it.
Yeah.
I've always wanted there to be an element where I'm doing something that isn't just me on my own in a room writing, but is more like producing or directing or, you know, other types of theatrical yeah. sort of endeavour.
So then sometimes you find yourself directing your own work. Is that true?
I try to avoid that as a general rule. I've done it once mm-hmm. With Midsummer.
Oh, yeah.
But Midsummer was written by Gordon McIntyre and me. He wrote the music, I wrote the words, and we put it together with Matt Pidgeon and Cora Bissett and Georgia McGuinness designed it. The reason I'm sort of hesitating on that is, although I directed it, that oddly felt quite Suspect Culture to me. It felt like we all made it together.
Sure. Uh-huh.
Like loads of the stories in that came from Matt or from Cora. So it's as a general rule, I wouldn't sit down and write a play with the intention of directing it, because I think that takes... It takes an obstruction out of the process that causes a problem. That you need there to be one mind causing problems for another mind. So the right. mind of the writer, your job is to write something that you don't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
If you know how to do it, it's going to be boring. You have to not know how to do it. And then the director comes along and goes, I think I know how to do this. And
sure.
And that tension is a really central key thing. And if you're writing knowing that you're going to direct, you're taking something out of the equation.
It's a little like we were talking to Suhaila El-Busher, who wrote The Arabian mm-hmm. Nights, and we talked about some of the amazing sequences that yeah. are in that script. And she said, I was told just to write whatever, you know, just yeah. write it. Don't worry about yeah. how we're going to do it or how much it's going yeah. to cost or any of that.
Yeah.
And then someone has to look at that and go, right, okay, so yeah. she turns into an eagle and how are we
yeah,
going to do
but
that?
That's going to be brilliant, isn't it? That's going to be interesting. That's the bit.
It has to
yeah.
be done.
I remember I was sort of pals back in the day with Sarah Kane, and I remember talking to her about naturalism. And one of the things she said was that it wasn't that she didn't like naturalism particularly per se. It mm-hmm. was that if you write, the rats come on stage and eat off his leg,
mm-hmm.
you know that you cannot, you know, you can't train rats.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. That isn't going to happen. Something is going to happen.
Yeah.
And it will therefore be amazing, interesting. It will be a theatrical thing. It will be a song. It will be, yeah. it will be represented by, you know, I don't know, by actors or whatever. But the point is they'll have to think of something interesting. And I think there is a truth to that part of the job of the writer is to think of things that you don't know how to do.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, that is also like, how do you make a monologue interesting?
Mm-hmm.
It's not the writer's job to make the monologue interesting. It's the writer's job to write the monologue, if that's what it is, and it's the director's job to make it interesting. I think that's the sort of... It's really important that there's a separation of powers. So what I mean is it's fine, you know, but it's not an encouragement. Like, it's not... writers have to do magical realism and that all they do is write he turns into a bat. It needs to be there because that's an amazing, brilliant idea in your story.
It has to be there.
But whatever you do as a writer has to be causing a problem. Otherwise, there's no point in doing it, would be my general thing. So that problem might be it's a monologue in a 1,000-seat theatre, or it's a cast of 30, or it's a cast of 3, and it's very intense, and it doesn't change scene. So then the problem that you've given the director is, how to keep the audience interested, how to keep it alive, but it always needs to be a problem that you're giving the director.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. In that sense, when you're adapting stuff, in a sense, you're given a bunch of problems.
Yeah.
In the first place. Where does your work on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory come in that kind of line of thinking? First of all, I want to know how that came about, because I'm interested. And secondly, what's that problem process?
So Charlie and the Chocolate Factory came about because my agent rang and said, I want to put you up for writing the book for the musical of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Okay.
And it was a kind of like almost like an audition process. The estate, the Roald Dahl estate, and the producers met a bunch of writers. And I went through a sequence of meetings. And I've sort of said this as a joke, but the first thing was, when my agent said, I'm going to put you up for Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, I was like, ha ha. Not even ha-ha, it was just more like, they're just not going to appoint me, so I'm not going to think about this. I'm not bothered. Do what you like, I think I was thinking, because why would the producers of a major West End musical who could pick anybody pick a Scottish writer who barely anybody's heard of?
Mm-hmm.
My agent, on the other hand, I think her point was that at that point I'd written 3 or 4 pieces for children and young people, Monster in the Hall, Yellow Moon, a piece called Gobbo, which did with the National Theatre of Scotland. I'm trying to think of it. Anyway, so it wasn't, I think from her point of view, it wasn't a crazy idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I just thought it was, it's whatever. Anyway, and so I just kept having these meetings. There's this very odd process where I would have a meeting and they would say, well, perhaps you could come to another meeting, but maybe this time you'd have a sort of treatment idea. And so I'd bring a treatment, and then it'd be another meeting where perhaps you could come to a meeting, but this time the meeting's in New York where you can meet the composers. So I'd go along to that. And then perhaps you could have a meeting which over 2 or 3 days where you could sort of come up with ideas. And it was really weird. I kept thinking there was going to be a moment where they'd say, thank you very much. It's been very nice to meet you. You've been great fun. Goodbye.
Sure.
But that moment never came. So there was never a moment where I was officially hired.
Oh, I see. They just keep saying, come over.
They just kept saying, come back. I mean, there was contracts exchanged hands at a certain point, but it was just this feeling of like, well, they haven't sacked me yet. So at some point, they're perfectly entitled to sack me, but they haven't sacked me yet. So I would stay in the game. But and actually, that was rather nice because oddly, because I never believed it was really real, I didn't try to land it. I pitched what I thought was right. It allowed me not to be intimidated. I assumed I was going to be sacked anyway, so it seemed to me no point in being sacked unless you were going to be sacked for your own idea. So So luckily that sort of balance worked out, and I ended up getting into it. And I think for me, the other way it fits in is that I love the musical form, but I didn't know that because I didn't really know much about musicals before I did this, and I sort of tried to learn as much as I could.
Mm-hmm.
But oddly, my big way in was through a lot of things from Scottish theatre about the kind of notion of the Cayley play, or the notion of Panto, or all of those things where music is absolutely central, where you speak out to the audience, where there's a kind of awareness. I thought, well, I like all of this, and it felt familiar, oddly. The other thing was, with Charlie was weird, because with Charlie, you would say, like in, I was used to working with Tag,
mm-hmm.
and with Tag, this, who are, you know, if you don't know, are a small ish. Well, it's the Citizens Theatre Education Department now. It was a separate theatre company called Tag,
yeah.
Theatre Bank Glasgow. And I was used to saying, you know, they get on a motorbike and they drive north. You know, that was a line in Yellow Moon. And I know that they have no resources, so I don't know how they're going to do that, but I know it's probably going to involve mime or sound effects or a song or something.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Whereas with Charlie, when I wrote the equivalent, you know, they get on a motorbike and drive north, actually they have a lot of money. It probably was, yes. going to be a motorbike and a, you know, something that might have been something approximating what I'd written, but yes. essentially the issue was the same. I just tried to create problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, again, fortunately in that one, I mean, there's so many interesting issues about Charlie as to try to adapt it, but certainly one of the big things is you don't, creating the problem is already there. I mean, you've got, yeah. squirrels that are supposed to eat Veruca Salt or tear her limb from limb, and you've got so it's already a problem. So really all I did was not try to solve that problem. I just translated, said the squirrels tear Veruca limb from limb, yeah. and you know,
so did you ever sit with the book and have any big head scratchy moments, or was it an exciting kind of grabbing it and just going with it kind of a feeling, do you think?
I must have done about 50 drafts of that,
really?
And then a lot of drafts all during rehearsals as well. And then when we did it in New York, we completely tore it up and started again and did different. I mean, the New York version was really almost completely different than the London version.
Oh, so, that much?
Yeah. So there was a huge amount of writing on Charlie. It was a kind of constant process. There was always. For me, the biggest head scratch with Charlie was really about Willy Wonka. When I was working on it, Dennis Kelly was working on Matilda, and I know Dennis a little bit, and I bumped into him in the Travis Bar One Festival when we were both working on these projects, and Dennis said, we were lamenting the work that we were trying to do, and Dennis said, the problem with Roald Dahl is he just fucking makes it all up as he goes along. And I knew exactly what he meant. And it, you know, it's a well-known thing that he used to go to his shed and write, and then he would go and tell the story to his kids, the bit that he'd just written, mm-hmm. and then he'd go back the next day and write the next bit. They're written like bedtime stories, and that's why they work brilliantly when parents read them to their children, that chapter by chapter it makes absolute sense what's coming next in mm-hmm. that context.
Yeah.
But in the context of a play or something that has an arc, a narrative arc that has to go through 2 hours, it falls apart. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And there's things, why have you put that there but not mentioned it back at the beginning? And why,
yeah.
you know, so Charlie would be a good example that Charlie's a play as a story. Its second half bears virtually no relation to its first half. It doesn't have any, you know, it sets up a whole bunch of stuff about the family and then they totally disappear. But Willy Wonka, who's the book's main character,
mm-hmm.
absolutely doesn't appear in the first half. I mean, he appears as a name, of course, but he doesn't appear. So which, if you know, just on that simple, just sort of theatrical technique level,
mm-hmm.
your star is going to be in the dressing room until the interval, if you do it following the book.
Yes.
Is that okay? I mean, you know, that's a question. There's just so much stuff about it that we had to think through. And we ended up in, we did this more for the American version, but for the London version, I had a very early on, I had this sort of very simple notion, almost cliched notion, maybe it is cliche, but it sort of, we never shook it off. Every time I tried to make it different, it felt fake, whereas the of this figure of the tramp, and the tramp was like, the tramp was essentially Willy Wonka in disguise, mm-hmm. And the notion was Willy Wonka has decided to hand over his kingdom, and he has gone out into the world in disguise to see what the world is like, because he's been locked away for so long, mm-hmm. and he wants to see if there's anybody worthy of handing over the keys to his kingdom. And of course he finds a fallen world that he doesn't like. It's, you know, people are greedy and they're insensitive, but in a there is this poor boy sort of scrabbling around on a rubbish heap looking for I was thinking about those rubbish heaps in like Bombay and in Nigeria where whole families sort of live just picking through kind of litter, and I sort of thought, well, that's not far off Charlie Bucket, you know, and his family at the edge of town and all grandparents sleeping in one bed and, so once I had that notion of this kind of tramp figure who Charlie doesn't know is Willy Wonka, and he says, you know, something like, there's just some beginning where he says something like, look at these greedy people all throwing their wrappers everywhere, and Charlie, we had this thing as well that Charlie picks up chocolate wrappers and he can't afford chocolate. So I was trying to think, how do you show that? How do you show that you can't afford chocolate? Because just saying it. So we had this thing that Charlie collects Willy Wonka wrappers, and he picks them off the ground, he sniffs them just to get the tiniest sense of the chocolate. And he says, oh, you know, this is a Wonka Whipple Scrumptious wrapper. It's the most, I'm so excited by it, you know. And so he's a connoisseur. You can tell in the first sort of few lines that he's a connoisseur of this, but he can't afford it. He can only pick the wrappers off the ground. So you've got this immediate thing of, and that was probably the first thing I wrote in the treatment was, look at these greedy people, they throw the wrappers everywhere and they don't even taste the chocolate. And he goes, I'm glad they throw wrappers because it means I can pick them up. And look at this one, it's amazing. And you suddenly go, oh my God, that's this kid is the one who we're going to follow, and this kid deserves something good to happen. So that came really early on, and I don't know if it solved a problem, but it certainly was something that we pushed at. And then the other big problem was trying to get to grips with almost like the theology of it. So it's like, it's really difficult because Dahl creates something where it's random. It's literally random that Charlie gets a golden ticket. And yet, and in some ways that's brilliant, but in other ways that's really difficult and frustrating because it's sort of, as a storyteller, that's a very hard thing to deal with, just total randomness. Mm-hmm. Basically, utterly random that he gets a golden ticket. And of course, in a night by night story, that kind of works, but in a play, it feels a bit awkward. So we needed to try to create a balance where it felt like you really believed he wasn't going to get a golden ticket, even though it's called Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and you can see coming a mile away that he's going to get a golden ticket, but you have to somehow create that feeling that he won't. So we had quite a lot of fun with that. But the theology, I guess, was, is Wonka God? Is Wonka benevolent? Does he know all this? Is he tricking? Is he messing with Charlie? And what we learned was that the crueler Wonka was to Charlie, the more believable and funny it was, because then at the end, when it turns out fine, you sort of know that all along he knew and he was sort of testing Charlie. And I think that's sort of where it ended up. But we did find that in the second half that we had to be cruel to the children. We had to be cruel to them, otherwise it didn't work. And that took quite a lot of head scratching because it feels very, and it doesn't feel right that you should be cruel to children on stage. You know what I mean?
But for the greater good, isn't it?
Well, I think it's very, what I realised was, because actually I became a little bit anxious about, because I thought, well, look, Mike TV watches TV a lot. Veruca Salt is assertive. Augustus Gloop, you know, what are we fat shaming Augustus Gloop? If the kid, Jesus, you know? TV plays with things. Well, my boy plays with him. Are we, you know, I sort of think of all these kids in the audience and this, are we licensing bullying, you know, effectively of these kids? But what I realized was particularly once kids started to come, I realized that they don't watch it that way. They watch it like this. They go, they see themselves in all of the children, and they also therefore see themselves as Charlie. So every kid goes, I'm a little bit like Mike TV, I'm a little bit like Veruca Salt, but I'm also a little bit like Charlie. And what they want is their own inner Charlie to win through.
Yeah.
And they enjoy and delight seeing the punishment of the parts of themselves that are, you know, greedy or, you know, whatever. Now, the other thing, of course, is that Willy, this is what we realised, Willy Wonka is exactly the same. So Willy Wonka is every bit as gadget-obsessed as Mike TV. In the book, it's, you know, he's got gadgets all over the place. He makes chocolate and eats chocolate. I mean, what's he talking about Augustus Gloop for? He's every bit as, you know, implicated in the chocolate scam as Augustus Gloop. He's every bit as bullying and assertive as Veruca Salt. He, you know, he... So there's something about understanding that actually... We are all the children, and therefore we have license in a way to mock and be cruel, as long as we keep this strong sense that the redemption belongs to Charlie. But yeah, anyway, sorry, it's a long way of saying we spent a lot of head scratching time on a lot of issues, but
And then I suppose what I always wonder is, A, how many times did you sit and watch that show once it was completely up and running, and B, how do you feel when that happens to you on any show, when you sit and watch it, when it's, if you want to call it complete?
Not once it was up and running. Once it had opened, I watched the Charlie in London, I watched twice. Charlie in New York, once it opened, I mean, partly because I don't live in New York, so it's not very easy. I haven't seen Charlie since it opened in New York. Obviously, because with a big musical like that, you do a month of previews. So I saw full-length run-throughs of Charlie New York probably 20 or 30 times.
Sure.
And obviously I'll see it again because it'll go out on tour, and I'll see it again. You know, I'll see it at various stages. But I, as a general rule, I don't really have any interest in seeing a show once it's opened. I'd like to go to last nights of shows and stuff like that, I would do, but... and Charlie wouldn't be much different than that. I don't feel the need. I think you're making it and you make it. And then, you know, mostly it would be a long time before I would see it. I know people will say this, but there's two different phases. There's the phase when you make it and you open it and you feel very sensitive about it. You want people to like it. I mean,
sure.
And then for me, usually there's another phase, which is when I see another production of that play 5 years or 10 years later. And then I have a very different reaction. And one part of the reaction is that it doesn't feel like it belongs to me in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very liberatory and very enjoyable. And the other is it becomes really... You can just see the author. It's like you realize... It's just so obvious. It's just, for me, it's like looking at a picture of, you go, oh God, I can see. It's like looking at a picture of yourself and going, why did I wear that, those glasses? Or, you know, why did I have my hair like that? Sort of a bit cringy, but mostly it's just this sense of it doesn't have any, I just have no sense of who it was or who that person is, or I don't know, you know. And I mean, with a play that people like, so for example, a play like Outlying Islands or something, which does get done quite a bit, the feeling I have is that I'm a person who, I'm like the agent of David Gregg, and I know, I understand that it's my job to represent that play. So when people say, oh, I like that play, I know that I go, thank you very much, that's very kind of you to say. But I don't have any emotional, I don't feel any reaction. I don't feel praised because it's not me who wrote it. I know that might sound odd, but, or at least I feel like, imagine suddenly you got praise for every Shakespeare play and people came and said, oh, I love Twelfth Night. And you just realised after a time that the best way to handle that social situation was to go, thank you very much, I'm very happy that you enjoyed it, rather than go, no, I didn't, you know, it's the same sort of thing. It's like, I understand that socially the right thing to do is accept that people liked it, or if they didn't like it, you know, to say, oh, well, I'm sorry you didn't enjoy my play. But I don't feel any sense, I don't know who the person was that wrote it, and I'm not him anymore, and I don't, I'm curious about it, but I'm sure. I'm not... I don't. Yeah, it's difficult to sort of. I don't have a relationship to it.
But on the opening night, when people speak to you and say things, then how do you cope with that?
I don't like it at all. I don't. Right. I hate it all. I really hate it.
The whole thing?
Yeah. I mean, even, to be honest, even shows that have gone really well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've had one or two shows where, like, I think it's because your brain is so fucked up. So put it this way, right? I've had shows that, when I look back in retrospect, were highly praised mm-hmm. at the time.
Yeah.
But it felt to me like they received insultingly mediocre responses.
Yeah.
I've also had plays that did receive insultingly mediocre responses. I've had plays that were hammered, you know, really hammered.
Sure.
I mean, genuinely, I'm not making that up. And to be honest, I can't distinguish, even, you know, it all felt crap. It all felt horrible because no praise is enough, you know, literally, unless when the thing goes down, you are physically lifted up by the audience on their shoulders and carried down Lothian Road whilst they chant your name. Even that, you would still sort of have this slight feeling of sort of post-coital tristesse, you know, that somehow...
I'd say they're drunk.
Somehow,
they
or something like it. Just nothing is enough.
No.
But so that's, you know, so even praise is still a kind of slightly disgusting thing. It's disgusting. It's also, it's like, you feel soiled. It's like, because it suddenly, it's as if that's why you did it somehow, you know, which probably is true. I mean, in a way, probably you are partly doing it because you want
approbation. You want people to like it, don't you?
I know, but...
And then when they do, you can't.
It's such a dirty. It's like showing people your knickers. It's like really. It's just. I would much rather that they watch it. I love standing at the back when it's on.
Mm-hmm.
I really like standing at the back when the show is on and hearing people respond. And if they love it, I really enjoy it. And if I can hear lines that I don't like or I think are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I think I feel that in my bones, and that's valuable. I go, right, don't do that, or that's a thing I've learned, or
yep.
you know, that I love. But actually, the encounter with the audience as a face, or indeed as a critic, you know, when you read the response, which of course is very, very painful, that's the bit that I don't like. I mean, I understand it has to exist, and you try to be as gracious as you can, but that's the bit I find most difficult.
Because there is a social contract, isn't there? And we kind of enter into it. And I say, oh, thanks. I always say, thanks very much. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah. No, but that's very
it's
nice.
Just, I do,
but
what it's
if
just
they didn't
out.
Enjoy it? Like, my very
I
first...
I often say I know what you mean. Because when they say things,
yes.
if I identify with them in any way, because I am a people pleaser, say, well, that was a bit dodgy how such and such. And I say, yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, in rehearsals, we did talk about it. And that's a...
I mean, I remember that my very first play that was professionally staged was Europe at the Traverse. And on its very first night, the audience gave, I thought, a very warm response. So I was encouraged and hopeful. And I was pretty much first up the stairs at the bar. And I thought, right, I'll just wait. And as people come up, I'll sort of hear what people have to say.
Mm-hmm.
And the first person who came up was Kenny Glenan, who was then a friend, and I would hope it would still be a friend. But Kenny came up and he said, David, I have to tell you what was wrong with your play. I had this moment where I wanted to go, okay, what would be kind is if you could save that for a couple of days. And and in fact, it was nice because, you know, people came up and they're very nice about my play. But I think my general feeling is I don't really want to know. No, I don't really want to know. It's so horrible. I know we have to go through first nights, but personally, if you could just box that and mm-hmm. If I could have an avatar or a robot, David, who could go through that experience for me,
yeah.
I would be very happy. I like everything on either side, but I don't like it. I love rehearsing, preparing, getting it ready. I love the preview audience. I adore the preview audience.
Mm-hmm.
I love the preview audience telling me things they don't like because then I can fix it.
Yeah.
I really love seeing it when it's in its run
mm-hmm.
and it's open and I can be with the audience in the back and just watch them. But that first moment I don't like.
Do you ever feel that you want to get up there and do it?
What, like act?
Yeah.
Well, no. I did want to be an actor to start with. That was mm-hmm. my first. That was what I thought. In fact, what I realised was that I liked the company of actors, and so I didn't really know as a kid. You know, as a youth theatre, I didn't really know any other way of having the company of actors except by being an actor. But then yeah. I learned there were other roles. But I do remember two moments where the vanity. I mean, of course, there's an element of vanity where you sort of think it, but. So the two moments were with Cicely Berry and the RSC. There was this sort of writer's workshop where Cicely Berry, who was the great voice teacher of the RSC, ran a workshop. And part of what she did to help writers understand their voice was she did some of the exercises she did with actors. And mm-hmm. I remember we were doing this workshop, and I was reading bits from Bond's Lear, and I was playing Lear, and various actors were sort of coming at me with chairs, and I had to kind of push these chairs out of the way and try and keep speaking. And it's a sort of typical actor exercise to give you a feeling of resistance or whatever mm-hmm, it was. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I was doing that, and Adrian Noble was showing dignitaries around, you know, the RSC's rehearsal rooms, and he came into the room, and it happened that I was doing this right. bit. And I remember thinking, I really sort of hoped, I had this feeling of like, I wonder if Adrian will say, David, your play was quite interesting, but having just seen your Lear, I wonder, have you ever considered
yeah.
treading the boards? But he didn't. And then the other one was when we did Midsummer, and it was already quite a successful production. We'd had it a few times, and it was coming back. And so we had a few sold-out performances at the Travers before it went somewhere, and Matt Pidgeon lost his voice. And... there was a few questions. Well, what could be done? What can be done? It's too late to get a replacement. We can't. Tickets are sold. What can we do? Yeah. What can we do? And, you know, I sort of didn't like to say, but, you know, perhaps, I don't know, maybe I could read in the role of Bob. And, you know, I sort of had this slight feeling. And I even remember sort of trying to be very modest about it and sort of going, no, I mean, you know, because the audience will enjoy, you know, the even though they've paid the ticket, you know, I kind of know how to do it, but they'll enjoy that I'm not as good as, but I'm reading from the book, but it's right. sort of a treat, you know, because you're seeing a special thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so Dominic Hill, who was then the artistic director, said, all right, well, let's see if this will work. So he sort of sat up in Travis One, and we basically tried to begin the play just to see how it would go, Cora and me. And I think I got 7 or 8 lines in, and I just heard from the dark, no. No.
And, that's harsh.
It was harsh, but it was yeah. true. I mean, it really okay. was true. Sometimes actors will say to me, how did you imagine this being said? Or, you know, how was this in your head? Or did you have an idea in your head? And a truthful answer is that there is a repertory company of actors in my head who do perform it as I write it. There is an older woman, there is an older man, there's a young, an ingenue, you know, sure. a fairly typical repertory company. And they do perform it. And there is a way I heard it in my head. The repertory company in my head are terrible actors.
Because, the whole company.
Yes, because I am a terrible actor. And so therefore, the way they do it in my head is pretty rubbish. Okay. And it's almost a great guideline of how you should not do the line that I write. Because you know, it's the most obvious, it's the most on-the-nose, cliched way you could do it. So
you never gave the line reading in the end?
I would avoid it at all costs, I think, once or twice. Sometimes for comedy, sometimes with comedy, there can be very specific
yeah.
timing things. But, and I hate to say this, you know, to an actor, but if it's got to the point that you're giving the line reading, they still won't get the laugh, even if they do it exactly like you line read it, because there's something, yeah. you should never be there. It's just a...
Something's missing at that point.
Something's not working. Yeah. And usually, to be honest, usually what's not working is the line. Or you've cast wrong, and if you've cast wrong, tough titty, rewrite it, because that's who's going on stage.
Sure.
So you might as well make it work for them, rather than sort of try and... So for me, I would always work that way around is
all right. Well, I hope I never get a line reading from you in that case, from the repertory company of David Gregg's head.
Yeah.
if that ever happens, I know I'm in trouble.
There'll be no need. No, but the thing is, it's just always the other way around. It's just so fundamentally the other experience to me is that the experience to me of actors doing my work is always, oh my God, I never saw that in it. Oh wow, that's so brilliant. Oh fantastic.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's Then let's keep it that way.
Yes.
Thank you very much for your time.
That's been a pleasure. Thank you.
There you go. Fascinating and inspiring stuff, I'm sure you'll agree. I found myself, after recording that interview, just totally fired up about all sorts of things that I hadn't even realised I was going to be fired up about. And listening back to it and getting it ready to bring to you today has done the same thing again. And I found new things in it. So it was great to talk to David. And it's got me going for this year, really. I'm getting started. Whilst I'm also having a wee holiday. I'm having a staycation. I'm back in Glasgow and Knightswood. And also that means that this podcast, this part of the podcast, is coming to you from my home studio again, so I'm back home, because I did loads of them in Edinburgh over the Christmas season and in different places, in dressing rooms and in digs and different things. Now I'm back in my wee home studio, I've got it set up again, it feels cosy and warm, Millie's here, the fire's on, and I'm bringing you as many episodes as possible from this very location this year. And that, if it's not exciting to you, is definitely exciting to me. And for the rest of the year, I'm going to be bringing you a new guest every single week on Putting It Together. That's the remit, and I thank you for listening and for being part of it. Please keep sharing and liking and telling your pals, and I'll speak to you next week. Cheerio now.